Ryan Cotter shifted the sling, transferring the weight of his scoped Steyr SSG-70 sniper rifle from his right shoulder to his left. Six dusty companions followed single file behind him, heading for the crude gate cut into the 12-foot-high berm wall. For the last third of a mile, they'd been breathing and eating the drifting grit thrown up by the wag caravan. For the last third of a mile, they'd been listening to the pre-dark party music, its sprightly cheerfulness like a dull dagger jammed in their guts, then twisted. It had taken every bit of Ryan's self-control not to break into a dead run, drop belly down on the summit with a 7.62mm long blaster, and start blasting the carny folk. Suicide, however, wasn't part of the plan. They had to act in stealth, lowering the odds from 8-1 against before showing their hand. The mechanics of the operation had been hatched over 4 days of one of the hardest forced marches the travelers had ever endured. They'd approached Bullard from the west, cross-country, over seemingly endless rolling hills and scrub forest, breaking their own trail and sleeping only a few hours each night. They'd pushed themselves mercilessly because they didn't want to risk arriving too late and uncovering another horror. For the 1,000th time, the image of the hand came into Ryan's mind. A grisly, ruined black hand, jutting from the earth in the middle of a long patch of churned-up ground. The flesh had been torn away. 3 fingers were missing down to the knuckles. Right off, he knew it was a woman's or a child's. It was so small and slender. Somehow, whoever it was had survived long enough to claw up through the smothering clods of earth. It had to have taken superhuman effort. They had carefully scraped back the top layer of soil. Cradled in the young woman's other arm was a dead infant. Her strength had come from desperation. The companions peeled back more dirt, exposing other bodies. Many, many bodies piled on top of one another. Both sexes, old, young, strong, weak. As soon as Ryan saw the tangle of limbs and torsos, he sent his 12-year-old son Dean away from the pit to wreck the rest of the ville. The boy left gratefully, but otherwise he would have remained to prove to the companions that he was made of the same rock-hard stuff that they were. There were close-range blaster wounds on a few of the corpses, but most were unmarked by obvious acts of violence. They never did find the bottom of the mass grave. The stench of death rained like hammer blows against their heads, and they staggered from the trench, bent over, retching.
Bastards chilled the whole ville.
Ryan put a strong, gentle hand on Christy Roth's shoulder. The Titian-haired, long-legged woman was his lover and soulmate. They'd seen many hard things during their wanderings over the hellscape, but rarely had they seen such wanton wholesale slaughter as this.
Not all, maybe.
Jack Lauren pointed at the cluster of shabby dwellings. It was a false hope, and from the look in the albino's ruby eyes, he knew it. But Jack, like everyone else, wanted to be away from the pit and its rotting horrors. A thorough search showed the nameless little ville had been looted of everything, just like the dead folk buried in the ditch. The huts and lean-tos had been stripped, the underground storage pits emptied. All that remained was the trash that was too heavy to be blown away by the howling wind. Uncovering the mass grave had flipped a switch in Doc Tanner's head. He'd stopped talking the moment they'd found the bodies of the mother and child. Normally, Doc never shut up. Ryan figured the discovery had triggered memories of Doc's own terrible loss of his long-dead children and wife, of the time trolling whitecoats from the future who'd snatched him from the natural course of his life in 1896, then played with him before bumping him farther down the timeline to this living hell. The old man hadn't participated in the speculation about what had happened in the ville, nor did he vote when it came time to decide what in rad blazes they should do about it, if anything. Some hours later, the companions tracked the overlaid tire prints of many heavy wags leading out of the place. Doc had suddenly started walking stiff-legged, like a tall, scarecrow zombie in his frock coat and high boots. After he'd taken several hard falls, despite the support of his sword stick, J.B. Dix had safety-lined him to his waist with a 15-foot rope to keep him from wandering off and breaking his neck. A week had passed since they came on the looted ville and the mass grave. A week of walking, first in the wheel ruts of the presumed chillers all the way to Perditionville, and from there overland to try to intersect the path of the already departed convoy. In that time, Doc hadn't improved, and JB still towed him. The peeling sweat on JB's face cut stripes of clean skin through the caked yellow grime. His wire-rimmed spectacles were smeared with a mixture of both. The wiry man wore his precious fedora hat screwed down on his head as he strained forward. Seeing the determination on his face made a flicker of a smile cross Ryan's lips. He had known John Barrymore Dick since their wild and woolly days with the legendary trader. JB had been that operation's armorer. They were best friends then. They were best friends now. JB never said he was sorry when he wasn't, and he never gave up. As Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner was dragged along, he railed at a god who was either absent or oblivious or malevolent, or all of the above. Doc was an educated man. He used big words. Complicated arguments chased his thoughts like angry wasps trapped inside his skull. He made leaps in logic, dropping out pivotal points, speaking from opposite points of view. At times, he seemed to be taking on the persona of his own Grand Inquisitor. The only companion with the background to unscramble his philosophical ravings was Dr. Mildred Wyeth, and she had long since given up. The solidly built black woman was a physician and had the most formal education of any of them. She'd been cryogenically frozen after a botched surgery just before Skydark, and reanimated by Ryan and the others nearly 100 years later. Mildred's diagnosis of Doc's current condition was grim. She'd said his overwhelmed mind had twisted in on itself. Anger reflecting anger, which led to agonizing flashbacks, reducing him to sobbing into his palms. The man was suffering from an unspeakable, unending ordeal, a price paid for no crime of his own, other than the exquisite bliss of his former life. In Mildred's medical opinion, Doc's rambling, often shouted diatribes to imaginary gatherings of Oxford dons allowed him to flee the crushing reality of the present, where he was doomed to exist without his beloved wife and children. Though Mildred sometimes acted as if she had little love for the old man, it was plain to see that she found it hard to watch and be helpless to slow his further mental and physical deterioration. However, Ryan remained cautiously confident that Doc would come out of this tailspin eventually, as he had always done before. As they neared the Ville entrance, the one-eyed man saw a pretty little girl in a loose-fitting, faded cotton-print dress staring at them from inside the gate. Her gaze swept past Ryan to rest upon Dean. The boy sensed he had a rapt audience of one. Though exhausted, he drew himself to his maximum height and flashed a smile at the girl. Ryan was amused to see that his son managed a bit of a manly swagger, with the 9mm Browning high-power blaster prominently strapped to his hip. Christy gave Ryan a playful nudge.
Like father, like son.
You're damned right.
A trio of armed men in bill caps stood behind a pile of concrete boulders and rubble that served as both a checkpoint and traffic barrier. Beyond them, Ryan caught his first glimpse of Bullardville, an oasis of brilliant green that sprouted miraculously from the sun-baked yellow earth. In rows of raised beds, under slanting, corrugated metal roofs, the crop plants grew lush and tall. On the far side of the beds, simmering in the valley heat, pre-dark plastic and metal signs on tall poles dangled precariously above a line of low buildings.
Man, oh day! Could I ever go for a cheeseburger and a strawberry shake?
We'll be lucky to get a plate of beans and a swig of green beer, Mildred.
I know, Ryan. But a girl can still dream, can't she?
As they stepped up to the checkpoint, one of the bill caps shouted,
And just who might you folks be? What's your business here?
The two other sentries held sawed-off 12-gauge double-barreled shotguns at waist height. They could easily cut the strangers not so neatly in two. Ryan showed the guards open hands.
We're just travelers on the long road north, come to water and rest, and willing to pay for it.
The head sentry, a very short man with a full brown beard, gave them a hard once-over. He looked especially long at their complement of weapons, appraising them for possible threat and commercial value. When he came to Doc, he couldn't help but notice the slack rope that connected him to the man with the smeared eyeglasses.
What's with the geezer? He sick?
No, he's just...
Well, he looks sick to me. He better not have the fucking Uzis.
Why? It's a damn good blaster.
You know what I mean, Four Eyes.
That disease is for cannibals. Do we look like fucking cannies?
How the hell are we supposed to know what cannies look like?
He's just old. Very, very old.
Ought to leave him to meet his maker, then.
Ain't his time yet.
We got a carny come to town.
That so?
The sentry shared wide grins.
Best red-blasted carny in all the Deathlands. Big show's tomorrow.
We'll have to stick around, then. Something like that you don't see every day.
Oh, you'd better believe it. Gert Wolfram's carny only plays the most important big-time bills.
You can stow your gear over where the carny's putting up camp. As long as you got something to trade, you got to run a Bullardville. There's food, water, joy juice, and the best damn gaudy house this side of perdition. When you run out of trade goods, we'll escort you out of the berm. We don't give no charity here, and we don't take no guff from those who don't belong.
Don't expect any from you, and don't expect none from us.
Good, then.